Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, why, here in Rome, St. Peter is never without St. Paul. Why Cataclysm? For the title of Chapter 32 of the Vatican Centuries. And Latin for a silly season postcard from Marrakesh. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. The 29th of June is a holiday here in Rome, and everyone knows why. It's the day the Church remembers the feast of Saints Peter and Paul. So, as promised, in a few moments we'll be joining scripture scholar Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn in Australia, who tells us why the Church celebrates these two apostles together rather than independently. And here in Rome, they're visibly never without one another. If you go into St. Paul's, there's St. Peter. If you go into St. Peter's, there's St. Paul. But the question is, they fought mightily in their lifetime. So what brought them so close together?
One of the most striking things about the city of Rome, one of the many striking things, is that it's not just that it's the city of St. Peter and Paul, as if you see Peter in some parts and Paul in other parts. In fact, wherever you go in the city, you never see Peter unless you see Paul, and you never see Paul unless you see Peter. They're always together. You walk into St. Paul's outside the walls, and there, standing up in the front of the Basilica, are big statues of both Peter and Paul. Similarly, you walk into Piazza San Pietro, and again you see heroic statues of the two of them. Not only do we see them represented together like that around the city, but in the church around the world. We celebrate their feast day on one day, 29th of June. And the question is, why don't we have a day for them each? Aren't they important enough, surely, to warrant a day? And yet, here we have them celebrated together in one city on one day. Now, this becomes all the more peculiar and interesting when you recognise that in life, they fought, and they fought about things that weren't just trivial, but went to the very heart of what Christianity and the Church are. The first time that Paul meets Peter is in those years after his Damascus Road encounter, when he's knocked down, stripped of power, and when he hears the call to be the apostle to the non-Jewish world. After that encounter on the road to Damascus, Paul vanishes into what he calls Arabia for quite some time, and then eventually emerges from the desert to undertake a mission, his first ever mission, perhaps, in Damascus. Again, his life is under attack immediately. He's lowered down the wall in a basket, and away he goes. And then beyond that experience of mission in Damascus, he decides to go up to Jerusalem. Now, for Paul, this was a very delicate moment because he was known to be a persecutor of the church. But he felt he had to go up and meet those whom he calls pillars of the church. He meant Peter, James and John. He calls Peter Kephas, which was Peter's name in Aramaic. Same nickname, means rock. But Peter, James and John were the big three, the Troika, in Jerusalem. So Paul, at this moment, is driven, as it were, to go up and meet them whom he had almost certainly never met before. Now, he needs a diplomatic bridge, someone who can introduce him to a community who was still highly suspicious of the former persecutor. And the diplomatic bridge he finds is the crucial figure in his life of Barnabas, real name Joseph. Barnabas was his nickname, son of encouragement. He must have been that sort of man. So Barnabas it is who takes Paul to meet Peter. And in his letter to the Galatians, Paul says that I went up to Jerusalem to, the word he uses in Greek is historesai, to historesai Peter. Now, this verb in Greek can mean two things. It can mean to give information to or to receive information from. I think Paul uses this verb precisely to say, I wanted to hear something from Peter and I wanted Peter to hear something from me. Now, what did he want to hear from Peter? He wanted to hear about Jesus. Paul had never met Jesus. I think when you read the letters, that's clear. He never knew Jesus personally, but Peter most certainly did. So he needs to hear a lot from Peter about the historical Jesus, who he was, what he did, what he said. Peter needs to hear from Paul, the real story, from the horse's mouth, as it were, of Paul's own conversion. So here they are, the two of them, for about a fortnight in Jerusalem, exchanging information, telling their stories to each other. Paul then vanishes from the scene. He goes home to Tarsus for a long time, and at this stage he could have plummeted off into the black hole of history. But in fact he doesn't, because again it's Barnabas who brings him back onto the stage as one of the leadership team of Antioch, where the gospel was first preached to non-Jews, to Gentiles. Barnabas was the one sent down from Jerusalem to discern this volcanic and potentially dangerous situation where the gospel is moving out of Judaism into the Gentile world. Barnabas needs to recruit the right kind of leaders, and he thinks Paul. So he goes to Tarsus, finds Paul, brings him back to Antioch, and there for about a year, we're told, Paul is part of the teaching team, the leadership team. Then he becomes part of the first ever Christian mission team to leave Palestine and enter the Mediterranean world. Barnabas was the leader of that first ever mission. Paul's the kind of vice captain, and John Mark is the third member of the team. They again preach the good news of Jesus to non-Jews out there in the Mediterranean world. And this creates enormous controversy in the infant church. And as a result, when they come back to Antioch, they have to go up to Jerusalem, again, to meet with the mother church in this moment of crisis and controversy. So Paul and Barnabas go up, and again Paul meets Peter in what's called the Council of Jerusalem. And it's Peter who eventually stands up and delivers a kind of compromise judgment, really, that the gospel is for the Gentiles, but the Gentiles need to respect Jewish sensibilities on certain counts. So here again, a second moment where Paul meets Peter. And Paul, like everyone else in the early church, deferred to the unique authority that Peter had received from Jesus himself. No one doubted that, certainly not Paul. The third time, and in some ways the last time that Paul meets Peter, is again in Antioch, where Peter has come down and he's sharing table fellowship with non-Jews, non-Jewish Christians. Jewish Christian and Gentile Christian sitting down at one table. Now this undermined the fundament of Jewish religious identity, which was separation of the Jewish and Gentile worlds. Now you had Peter and Paul sitting down as Jewish Christians with non-Jewish Christians, sitting at the one table to eat and to celebrate the Eucharist, therefore. Some of the James Party, as they're called, some of the conservative Jewish Christians from Jerusalem, James was the residential leader of the church in Jerusalem, come down and they say, you can't eat with them. You Jewish Christians have to separate. We have one church, two tables. And Paul says, no, wrong way, go back. You are re-erecting the barriers that God has knocked down in Jesus. Therefore, you are doing the work of Satan. At this stage, Peter and Barnabas agree with the James people who have come down from Jerusalem, and Paul looks a very isolated figure. He has to make a decision. He could have either gone home to Tarsus, just said, it's a bad joke, I'm out of here, or he could have said, well, you were right and I'm wrong, I beg your pardon, I didn't want to create all the trouble. Or, and this is what he does in fact, he could decide to set up his own mission team. So what comes to birth in this brawl at Antioch is the independent Pauline mission. And the issue that Paul and Peter fight about is really the nature of the church. Is the church a kind of sect within Judaism? Or has it been born from the womb of the synagogue as some new, distinctive initiative of God's. Paul says that Christianity is not just part of Judaism. It has been born, thrust forth, as it were, from the womb of the synagogue as something new that God is doing for all people, not just for Jews, but for Gentiles as well. At that stage, Peter and Paul part ways. Paul will reappear in Jerusalem from time to time, but we don't exactly know what went on there. He will never again return to Antioch as he sets forth on the path of his independent mission. Eventually, the stories of Peter and Paul will converge. Their paths will cross in the most decisive way, because both of them were among the Christian leaders in Rome in the mid-60s who were swept away in the tide of blood that came with the persecution of the Emperor Nero. So both suffer a martyr's death, that much is certain. Paul is beheaded on the way out to Ostia, at what is now Tre Fontane. Peter is crucified in what was Caligula's circus, and that is now St. Peter's Square. Now, what happens in this moment is that in the moment of their death, and Rome is the city of their death, they didn't found the church in Rome, but they died here. In the moment of their death, they find their way so completely and so profoundly to Jesus crucified and risen that they find their way to one another. That's the key. They find a communion in Jesus crucified and risen in their death that they didn't and couldn't find in their life. So why does the church celebrate the memory of the two of them so intensely in one city where they're always represented together and celebrate their memory particularly on one day, the 29th of June? Because in this, the city of their death, they become so completely, as it were, immersed in Jesus. They become Jesus, crucified and risen, that they move beyond all their differences and disagreements to find their way into that perfect communion which is in Jesus, crucified and risen. And that's why the Petrine ministry, the papacy, looks not just to Peter, but also to Paul, because the Pope, as heir to the witness of both Peter and Paul, the Bishop of Rome, is the prime servant of the communion which they found in death.
And a big thank you there to scripture scholar Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn in Australia. And now our weekly rendezvous with Jill Bevilacqua as she presents episode 42 of The Vatican Centuries, a programme produced by Sean Patrick Lovett, in which Jill takes us back in time to rediscover some of the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican down the centuries. While last week we heard how the temporal power of the papacy ends, how Pius IX proclaims the dogma of the Immaculate Conception and calls the first Vatican Council, in this week's episode, by the title of Cataclysm, we hear how the papal chamberlain becomes Pope Leo XIII, how he issues the encyclical Rerum Novarum, and how this Roman pontiff offers the cardinal's hat to John Henry Newman.
Our own times are almost at hand. There are those still living among us who remember the latter events which follow, for they lived through them, while the personalities are familiar childhood figures.
In the last decades of the 19th century, the pace of life was still gentle, but already industry and technology were making themselves felt. The European continent was still their centre, and the old world continued to grow rich and to expand.
Rivalry was developing between the groups of European powers over trade, colonialization, and naval and military supremacy. Two alliances were formed, the Triple Entente between Britain, France and Russia, and the Triple Alliance between Germany, Austria and Hungary. The stage was set for conflict.
But men still sought to conquer nature. This was the era of polar exploration, of Peary, Amundsen and the gallant band of Robert Falcon Scott.
In 1912, the great ocean liner Titanic struck an iceberg on her maiden voyage to New York and sank with over 1,500 passengers.
Only a few years previously, the city of San Francisco had been destroyed by earthquake and fire. Acts of God abound in every age.
Medicine was going ahead in leaps and bounds. X-rays, adrenaline, vitamins, and blood groups. Pierre and Marie Curie discovered radium, while a man named Sigmund Freud published a disturbing book. Psychoanalysis had arrived.
Inventions proliferated. After the phonograph came the gramophone, the fountain pen, the safety razor, zip fasteners, tape recorders, vacuum cleaners.
But some of man's new toys soared above all the others. And when, in 1903, Wilbur and Orville Wright made the first controlled flight in a heavier-than-air machine, it seemed that nothing was impossible to the mighty human intellect.
More homely, but likewise a sign of the future, was the appearance of the first motor car, built by Benz and Daimler, and later popularized by Henry Ford, who put the cheap motor car on the general market.
It was a time that saw the beginnings of nuclear physics, of experiments in cinematography, and, nearer home, radio telegraphy. An Italian named Guglielmo Marconi was sending wireless messages.
People were dancing to the music of Johann Strauss, enjoying opera after opera of Verdi. Serious folk were listening to Tchaikovsky and Brahms. Delighted English audiences laughed at the operettas of Gilbert and Sullivan, which poked fun at pomposity.
The paintings of Gauguin, Renoir, Van Gogh and Toulouse-Lautrec kept the Impressionists in the forefront, while the plays of Anton Chekhov and the novels of Henry James gave the intelligentsia food for thought.
Agitation was the order of the day. The Great London Dock Strike in 1889 was supported by Cardinal Manning of Westminster. The suffragette movement was in full activity. The granting of old age pensions gave recognition to senior citizens. The 20th century lifestyle was on the way in. And in Rome, its effects were already beginning to show.
One of the essential acts a pope must perform before he dies is to appoint a chamberlain or camerlengo of the Holy Roman Church. Always a cardinal, the chamberlain is responsible for administration of church property and revenues while the papal throne is vacant. On the pope's death, he automatically becomes head of the sacred college, assembles the conclave, and remains in charge until a new pope is elected.
Traditionally, the cardinal chamberlain had little chance of being elected pope. But on February the 20th, 1878, after the speediest election in history, only three ballots were taken, the man who had guided the church through the difficult period of the interregnum was chosen to succeed Pio IX. He took the name of Leo XIII.
The coronation of the first pope without temporal power took place in the Sistine Chapel instead of in St. Peter's, because the Italian authorities refused to guarantee law and order. Leo XIII infuriated the Italian liberals and displeased the Romans by giving the customary blessing to the city and world not from the central balcony of St. Peter's, but instead from inside the basilica. Coexistence between church and state was not going to be easy.
Sixty-eight-year-old Gioacchino Pecci was no haphazard choice for the chair of Peter. He had wide pastoral experience. He was a born diplomat and an able administrator.
But what the new pope represented more than anything else was a more open, conciliatory attitude to the secular world. Pius IX had made the church a close corporation, isolating the papacy and turning his back on the modern world. Leo XIII realized that the church could and should live in harmony with it. Only then would she recover her loss of influence and the papacy its prestige.
Pope Leo XIII is probably remembered today chiefly for his encyclical Rerum Novarum, published on the 15th of May, 1891. The Pope saw that the Church would have to appeal directly to the workers if they were not to be lost to socialism.
Leo XIII was 68 when he became Pope, and he lived to be over 90. The aim of his pontificate was to Christianize modern life and to modernize Christian life. He believed he could present the Church and the papacy as a world power with a spiritual mission.
But by the turn of the century, Leo's optimism had faded. The fanatical hate of the Freemasons and the general aversion for the organization of the Catholic Church was closing in on him. The Roman question, too, was a constant drawback to real dialogue. An article in the Daily Telegraph of the year 1899 described the Pope's position.
The Pope is alone in the Vatican, without a friend among the governments of the world, without territory, without treasure, without an army, without power, without a voice in the Senate of Nations, a prisoner in his own palace, begirt by the troops of a hostile king. His visible sovereignty is indeed gone. Nevertheless, his invisible sovereignty was perhaps never stronger than today. With all the forces of the world against him, he has fought the fight well and drawn tighter the bonds of respect and love and obedience which knit the Roman Church into one harmonious whole. Its unity never more absolute, its purity never more apparent, its authority never more loyally recognized.
In 1903, Giuseppe Sarto, Cardinal Patriarch of Venice, ascended the papal throne. Known above all as the Pope of Frequent Communion, Pius X lowered the age for reception of the Eucharist to 7 years and encouraged devotion to the sacrament. He also promulgated a new version of the Catechism and himself gave Sunday school sessions to the children of Rome. Two of those children were Carola and Francesca McMurrah.
We saw him every time we could, we'd go to see him. We just loved Pius X. We love those beautiful blue eyes, you know. I remember saying to Mother, Mother, the Holy Father has blue eyes. And they were full of light. And they looked down on you, I don't know, with such light and a twinkle in them too, you know. But such sweetness, you know. Everybody loved those eyes, you know. They were the eyes of a saint.
It fell to the gentle Pius X to be the helpless witness of a cataclysm which no other pope before him could have imagined.
On June the 28th, 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria was assassinated by a Bosnian student.
Instantly, the dogs of war were unleashed. The First World War, a war which was to claim 40 million human lives.
When Pius X was asked to bless the Austro-Hungarian troops, he exclaimed, "I bless peace," but he did not live to see it. On the 20th of August that same year, he died, so people said, of a broken heart, while all around him the lamps of Europe went out.
And special thanks there once again to Jill Bevilacqua for part 42 of The Vatican Centuries, and of course to Sean Patrick Lovett, who produced this series. They'll be back again at the same time next week, so be sure to join them then. Finally, on a more summary note, we join our popular Latin lover Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, who helps me send a postcard from Marrakesh in Latin, of course. Father, in English, during the summer, journalistically, we say it's the silly season. There's not a lot of news. How would you say the silly season?
Well, you'd say either etas or tempus stultitiae.
Tempus stultitiae.
Tempus stultitiae. So the time of nonsense.
The time of nonsense. I'd like to have my little postcard. How do you say postcard?
Cartula cursualis. Why? Cursus was the postal system. And that's in your dictionary there, if you have a Latin dictionary. Cursualis. So we say cartula cursualis. Just the Romans had, heaven's sakes alive, the Romans had all this stuff.
They had postcards.
Well, they had the cursualis. They had horses. They used to say, they call them equi cursualis, postal horses. You know, to bring the stuff around the empire.
Yeah, I want to write a postcard in Latin, okay? I flew to Marrakesh in Morocco.
Either you're going to say volavi or aerium iter feci, Marrakesh in Marocchiam.
Okay. And I stayed in a bungalow.
At Pernoctavi in a bungalow. Anyway, I understand. At Pernoctavi in Casula. Casula, a small house.
The first day.
Ergo, iter feci in Marrocchiam. Ibique pernoctavi in Casulam, in a small house.
The first day I went to the souk.
What's the souk?
The bazaar.
Yeah, what am I? Primo die, adii, adii, I visited Mercatum.
I bought a carpet, but I had to haggle for the price.
Okay, tragulum emi, sed necesse fuit, de pretio contenderem. But I had to fight about the price.
They ripped me off, by the way.
They ripped me off. Qui me diripuerunt. Well, qui me... Okay, diripuerunt. They devastated me.
The carpet was once in a Berber tent.
Oh, my lord. I would say, Stragulum custodie batur aliquando. The carpet used to be guarded or kept aliquando once upon a time in... Okay, in Alicuyo's Burberry Tabernacolo. Isn't it nice? It's much better in Latin.
It's like tabernacle.
Well, yeah, which is a tent.
And the carpet was brought here on the back of a camel.
Hoque in cameli dorso ad latum est. That's easy. The things are easy. Okay. It's the concepts that are hard.
But the next day I went to the main square to watch... The snake charmers.
Bene, postero die adii forum maximum. Ut serpentium incantatores spectarem.
As well as the storytellers that seem to have popped out of the Middle Ages.
Ma va. Nec non fabularum narratores. No? Narrators of stories. Qui videbantur ex media etate prorupisse.
By this time, we were hot and sticky. How do you say hot and sticky in Latin?
Hociam tempore... Ah, that's all right. We were hot. Estuabamus and sticky et... Well, I could say our clothes were sticking to us.
And we
et nobis adherebant vestimenta.
And we made our way to the hammam.
What's the hammam?
It's like a Turkish bath.
Yeah, I don't know that.
You can say bath.
And bene, viam invenimus ad balneam turkica.
And then we ended the day with a tour of the palm grove at sunset.
I would say decidente sole, as the sun was going down.
The sun was dying, decidente, no?
Decidente, was going down. Was going down, was falling down. Gestationem absolvimus, or terminavimus. We ended our gestatio, our little tour. What did you say with what?
We ended the day with a tour.
Terminavimus diem. Mm-hmm. Gestazione with a tour
of a palm grove at sunset.
Oh no. Palmeti, no, palmetum. Palmeti, and then sunset ad solis ocasum. Going down to the sun.
How would you say lots of love?
They didn't say that.
How would they sign off?
They were okay, they would say etiam atque etiam valete. Etiam atque, etiam valete.
Meaning?
Be in good health again and again. And the students see that and I said, now you could send this home tonight.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, who spent most of his life as papal Latinist. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.